Thank you all for coming today. I can't wait to learn more about my mother that I didn't already know. And I know that she is so happy to be here and so thrilled to be receiving this honor. And I think she wanted to make an opening statement.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a thrill to be back at BoucherCon. I was at them so many years ago, there were about two tables of us. If Otto Penzler is in the audience, he will agree. And to think that it is now 1,500 people, and so many writers, so many fans, so many librarians, so many booksellers, God bless you all. And it's so much fun to be with you. And people were reminding me, remember when we were all singing around the piano at 1 in the morning in Muncie, Indiana? I said, dear God, I hope I wasn't singing. They said, no, you were helping with the words. I said, okay.
Let me just ask if the sound is okay. Or
can you hear us?
Or it would be better if we hold them. Yeah, when you turn away from the mic, it's hard.
Oh, okay, so I should kind of be straight ahead. Okay.
All right.
Very good.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to ask my mother questions, but then she also really wants to hear from you all and the questions you have, because, again, it's nice to be with all the people who read her books. So, all right, Mom. This is Mary Higgins Clark, and...
And this is my girl child, Carol Higgins Clark.
Thank you. Okay. I just have to say, I remember being in high school, and I was doing homework, and she was at the dining room table. It was a Sunday, and she was typing something. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, here, read this. And it was the first chapter of Where Are the Children? And I said, oh, this is good. What are you doing? She said, I think I'm going to try writing a suspense novel. So... I think it turned out well. So, Mom, when did you? I know you always wanted to be a writer, but what was your first conscious moment of being a little kid and you knowing you wanted to write?
Well, it started when I could put a sentence together, because you know people say, "When did you decide to be a writer?" And for me, it didn't happen like that. And some of you have heard me tell the story, because after all these years, you know, you do get into twice-told tales. But I firmly believe that at the cradle, the legendary godmothers come and they leave their gifts. The one who might have given me the grace of a ballet dancer did not arrive. I have no ear for music, so as a result, I'm not graceful as a dancer, because it follows. And the one who might have had helped me to sew a fine seam did not show up. The girls remind me their school uniforms were scotch taped, the hems, and that's entirely true. And no one has ever begged an invitation to my dinner table. Although I raised five children, none of whom were malnourished. But I remember the day that I contributed a pineapple upside down cake to the church. You know, they were selling them after every mass. And mine came out a little lopsided. And one of the young priests used to come to watch the baseball games with Carol's father. And he arrived after the 12:15 carrying my pineapple upside down cake. He said it was the only one that didn't sell. So the one godmother who came said, you are going to be a storyteller. And thank God that she was the one who showed up. Because from the time I was six, when I could write a sentence, I was writing a poem. I was writing a skit and making my brothers perform in them. Joe was a year and a half older. Johnny was 3 years younger. And I was writing skits, and I remember Johnny, and then I directed them in them. And I remember Johnny saying, can I be the star just once? I said, no, the right is the star. Here's your line. And of course, it doesn't hurt to be born into an Irish family. Just to do a quick background, my mother and father kept company for 7 years, which is very Irish. She was 40 and he was 42 when they married. And You know how an Irishman proposes. If you don't, I'm telling you right now. Nora. Nora. Would you care to be buried with my mother? Well, she had had a career. She was the bridal buyer of B. Altman and Company. She had been the second oldest of nine children, so of immigrant parents, Irish, of course. And she said, I never wanted to get married at 19 and start again. I wanted a career. So that was the way it worked. But then she immediately produced my older brother, barely 9 months later. He was a preemie, Joseph. 19 months later, Mary. And at age 45, she gave birth to my little brother. And the doctor came in the room. She has the baby in her arms and the rosary in her fingers. And he said, I assume this one is Jesus. It's a first cousin, John. I said, Mother, how many nights did you walk the streets figuring out those names? Will you please tell me? But, you know, when you're from an Irish family, she was one of five girls and four boys. And the girls got together more often. And maybe once every month at least, they'd be over to our house for dinner. And the teapot would be kept on. And the stories after dinner would go. And I'd love to sit and listen. And if I didn't fidget, I could sit at the table and have weak tea. And my brothers, of course, had absolutely no interest. But you heard the stories of bad bargains made at the altar and endured for a lifetime. Oh, Katie, the beauty that she was. Remember? And she married that one. Could have had Ray O'Keefe. Never married. Became a judge. Always crazy about Kate. And she was stuck with that one. And then Anna Curley. Oh, dear God. The pity of it. 1917, the flu epidemic. She died a week before the wedding. She was buried in her wedding dress. She was engaged to my uncle, Jim. And Jimmy said on the day of the funeral, I'll never draw another sober breath. And then someone said, wasn't he a man of his word? So I heard the stories of the good days and the bad days, the sometime days and the perhaps days. And I just drank them all in because all I wanted to do was write stories about them. In high school, all through school, I was writing short stories, even in grammar school. In high school, I finally, math and science, and I was a scholarship student, so I had to keep up my marks. But I wasn't interested. I was writing a short story. And when I went back to Villa Maria Academy, and I had 15 bestsellers under my belt, and the math and science teacher was sitting in a wheelchair, 90 years old, and she looked at Meg with those clear gray eyes. She never forgot one of us, and her comment was, you were a dreadful math student, Miss Higgins. And I curtsied to her as we did in those days, and I said, God bless your memory, Reverend Mother. So it was always that. And I went to secretarial school because my father had died when I was 11. My mother rented rooms to try to save the house. It was the way it is now. He had a successful bar and grill. But in those days, people signed. They didn't have credit cards. So they ran up their credit and they signed for dinner and they signed for drinks and they signed and they signed. And if you finally said, look, you just have to pay your bill, they opened an account down the block. And he literally died of stress in his sleep when I was 11. And I thought, I'm not going to college now. I'll go to secretarial school and I'll get a job. Because my brother had died in service at 18. Which, of course, broke my mother's heart. In fact, there's another quick story about that one. She worshipped all of us. She would have thrown herself across the tracks for any of the three of us. But Joe, the firstborn, was her heart. And I came across a diary she had kept, and I just loved it. She wrote in it, Joseph was a preemie. I never left Joseph that first year. I was so afraid he'd slip away. He was the most beautiful baby, The other two had allergies. And I called up Johnny. I said, get a load of this. But I understood. I mean, Joseph was the leader, the captain of the team, the first in his class every year, you know, the special person. Anyhow, I thought, I've got to get a job. And you know how sometimes you regret, as I saw my friends packing off for college, and I went to Wood Secretarial School in Grand Central Station, Pershing Square, and you know how it sometimes can work out for you very, very well, because at 18, I got a job as secretary to the creative director of Remington Rand, and they had their own in-house advertising agency. So for the next 3 years, I was sitting in on the creative meetings and taking notes, why this campaign worked, why this did not work, why this caption worked, why the inside front pages of Life, Look, Post, and Collier were better than something else. And I had a 3-year tutorial in advertising, which served me very well when I was widowed at age 36 with 5 young children, because I knew the advertising field and I could get right back into it. So that's a quick answer to a short question at the beginning.
You know what, maybe I'll put your mic on the other side, because might be better.
Am I not?
No, can you hear? Can you all hear fine?
Yeah, okay, yes? I'll try to remember to keep bobbing my head.
No, it's not that. It's just you turn. I'm just trying to be a good person. Can everybody hear fine? Yeah. No, yes? I'll switch it over.
That's okay.
No, it's just because you...
Yeah, I should know enough.
No, that's not it. Okay. I think that's better. Okay. We're all here because we love mysteries. And however, my mother's first book was a biography of George Washington. And when she started, there were 1,500 copies in print. The publishing company went out of business. She said it wasn't her fault. And and then she decided to try and write suspense mystery novels. But after she became popular as a suspense writer, mystery writer, we realized we all didn't have our own copies of Aspire to the Heavens. So my mother, and of course we wanted to start collecting her books, so my mother called a book tracing service and said, if you can find any. And a month later, she got a call, went down and paid $100 for a copy, one of those 1,500 copies, opened it up and screamed. It was the autographed copy she'd given to her boss.
And for Clarence, Alona, and Claire Ann, hope you enjoy the fruits of my moonlighting. Love, Mary.
Okay. And one of the first pieces of advice my mother gave to me about writing was, if someone's mean to you, make them a victim in your next book. Because that didn't work out, she turned to mysteries, and tell why.
Well, actually, the minute I married Carol's father, and I was just, it was 2 days after I was 22, and I had been a Pan American flight hostess for a year, which was a great experience. I had thought, I want to do something after 3 years in advertising. And I went into, a friend was a Pan American flight hostess, and I couldn't think of anything more glamorous than to be, and this is 1949-50, so I give myself away totally. But I thought, to see the world. And I did get the job, and I just have to give one quick story about that, because in those days it was the Connies, propeller aircraft. We went to Gander, got off after 4 hours, and then got on the next plane the next night and flew 11 hours to London. And my very first night in London, my very first, Green Park Hotel and off Moon Street, and I said, it was one girl with 9 men on the crew in those days, and I said, oh, we're in London, let's see London, let's walk around London. They said, honey, you've walked across the Atlantic. We'll have dinner, we'll take you out for drinks, we'll have drinks here, we'll take you around tomorrow. So I said, if you guys think I'm going to sit and drink on my first night in London, and I walked down off Moon Street, and I stood at the Green Park Hotel, and I said, and I know the palace is that way, and I know Trafalgar Square is that way, and there was a tap on my shoulder, and this lady with a lot of makeup, hair all over the place, a ratty fur's head. Beg your pardon, love, but this is my corner. Well, I flew for a year. I got it out of my system. I got married, and the minute we came back from the honeymoon, I said, I have got to learn how to be a professional writer. And I walked down to NYU. And that's something I always advise people to say, I know I can, I know I can. When you're in a class, you get direction. You get an assignment. You're with other people who are trying to do the same thing. To buy yourself a computer, or obviously have one in this day and age, and sit down and say, now between 9 and 11 I'm going to write. It's awfully tough. But you know, after the first few, because it was short stories in those days, after the first few classes, the professor said, you are being assigned to write a short story. And of course we looked dismayed. He said, I know what you're all thinking. What am I going to write? I don't know anything I'm going to write. And he kind of talked like this. And he said, I'll tell you what. Write about something you know. Interesting. He said, maybe there's a family secret. It's always been whispered about. Maybe you've read a case in the newspaper, a trial that's going on, or an article, and it intrigues you, and you think about it. He said, ask yourself two questions, suppose and what if, and turn that true case into fiction. I have been doing it ever since. Suppose, what if, and I have asked one more question, which is why? Because if four people might have committed the crime, had every reason to, had the justification, and had the availability, only one would have gone over the line. And I've been writing suppose, what if, and why. And I did it with short stories. The first one took 6 years and 40 rejection chips to sell. But it turned out it was a Pan-American background, but it was a suspense story. And for that, I was able to get into MWA all those thousands of years ago. That story came out in 1956 or 7, I think. All those years ago, I joined MWA. And I remember Rex Stout was sitting in an armchair, and he had a long beard, and he looked like God. And I thought, this successful writer, and I'm in the same room with him. And then we were house hunting, and he had a big estate in Stamford, Connecticut. And down the hill, there was this little Cape Cod house for sale. And we looked at it. Well, you couldn't buy it because it needed everything. But I thought, maybe if we buy it, the shadow will fall upon me. But getting back to Where Are the Children, I sold short stories for throughout the 50s and early 60s. And pretty regularly, really, I was selling, of course, you know, you got a 1,500 for one and 100 for another. But then the short story market absolutely ended. And that was just the time when Carol's father died. And I was able to get a job writing radio shows for an advertising agency. And the first one that I wrote was called Portrait of a Patriot. And it went like this. He was the tailor from Tennessee who became president of the United States. Do you know who he is? Halfway through, have you guessed who he is yet? Well, here are more clues. Arthur Kennedy, who was a wonderful actor, was the voice on it. And then tune in tomorrow and buy Taster's Choice Coffee at the same time. And another one. At age 14, she was given the family tree and said, but I am nearer to the throne than I realized. Do you know who she is? Halfway through, have you guessed who she is yet? At the end, Victoria Regina, Queen of England, Empress of India and all her realms and territories. Tune in tomorrow. And the one guy I ducked was George Washington, our president, because I thought, he is so boring. So boring. The cherry tree, I cannot tell a lie. And I thought, well, I can't skip the first president. And then I started to research him. And I thought, why don't we know this man? Why don't we know him? First of all, I had read that he married an older woman for her money. Yes, she was older, 8 months older. She was 27 to his 26. She was the richest widow in the colony of Virginia. He courted her at her home, the White House. They had a love affair that lasted 40 years. He wore her locket always under his cravat. She went through the British lines to join him in Boston, and she spent that awful winter at Valley Forge with him. And I thought, I want people to know about this man. And I spent 3 years, in the little time I had, in primary research about George Washington. And my agent had been saying, Mary, you've got to write a book. There is absolutely no market for short stories. You've got to write a book. And one day I bumped into her. I hadn't given her anything in a couple of years. And she said, write a book. And I said, Pat, I'm writing a book. Oh, she said, thank God, what about? And I said, George Washington. And she looked at me. And her cheeks got splotchy and her eyes narrow and her lips thin. And she said, why? And I gushed about all the reasons I just gave you when she interrupted me and said, love story between those two. Listen, Mary, with those wooden teeth, the only thing George gave Martha was splinters. Well, I wrote the book, $1,500 for 3 years' work. It published 1,700 copies, most of which disappeared immediately. And that was when I said, well, at least I know I can write a book. I'm going to write one that will sell. And that was when I looked at my shelves and realized that from the time I was little, Nancy Drew, Judy Bolton, Agatha Christie, all of them, Minion Eberhardt, everybody, I devoured mystery. And I, as a child, wanted to be the first one to know who did it. I wanted to say, this doesn't mean anything, but this means. And I didn't realize I was teaching myself how to write mystery suspense fiction. And that was when I thought, if I write one, what will it be about? And at that time, again, the advice of the professor, maybe it's a trial that you're interested in. And Alice Crimmins was on trial at that time for the deliberate murder of her two children. I did not write about her. I switched the premise. Suppose an innocent young mother is found guilty of the death of her two children. Suppose she gets out of jail on a technicality, as Alice did in both cases. Suppose the witness is missing. He was going to be drafted for Vietnam and took off for Canada. Suppose she remarries. Her husband knows the story. And 7 years later to the day, the children of her second marriage disappear. And I thought, that's a good premise. And for the next 3 years, in between, you know, a full-time job, I wrote, Where Are the Children? And I called it Die a Little Death, because I had read a journal of the mistress of Louis XIV, a mistress, and her baby died when it was 8 months old. And in her journal, she wrote, And I, with my baby, died a little death. And I thought, in this book, Nancy has blocked out the day her children died, her first children. And now she must remember what happened every minute of that day in order to save the lives of her second children. And I submitted it to Pat, my agent, beloved agent. My youngest child is Patricia Mary. Pat is gone now. She had retired anyhow years ago. But I didn't hear from her for 6 weeks. And I finally called, because Pat was formidable. She had been a senior editor, and she would rip apart a short story when I brought it in. I said, Pat, have you had a chance to look at the book? And she said, oh, yes, she said, I have it in circulation. I said, you mean you don't want me to rewrite it? She said, absolutely not. It's perfect the way it is. I said, then it's going to sell. Well, she said, you can hardly say that. I said, if you approve it, it's going to sell. Well, Harper and Row turned it down because they were afraid children in that kind of jeopardy might upset their women readers. It's never on camera, but as an adult, you realize those first two children had been molested. And it's never on camera. And then it went to Simon & Schuster, and they bought it for, I guess, $3,000. And the editor was wonderful, and she said, "We don't like it to be called Die a Little Death, because we want to publish you as a novel of suspense as opposed to straight crime fiction. We want to put you in the novel category." And she suggested, "Where Are the Children?" And of course it was wonderful. And what I love, you know, we always love to have the guy who turned us down come to us. And it was Harper who turned me down. I think it was Harper and Row at that time. And I was sitting at a dinner table, and I was next to the chairman of Harper and Row, and he said, "Is there any way we can disenchant you with Simon & Schuster?" I said, "What'd you turn me down for?"
So I know you're answering it, but a lot of people here are writing as well. And so in general, I know it's a question that's often asked, but where do you get your other ideas then too? Or what inspires you when you're starting a new book to just form the concept?
Well, sometimes something leaps out at me from the paper. I wrote a book, Just Take My Heart. It's about 3 books ago. And I had read the Post, the New York Post. I mean, it's such a gossip thing. But you'd be amazed what you can find for a story in it.
And their headlines are great.
No, but page 3 had the story of a man who had had a heart transplant. A 32-year-old young man who was a chronic depressive had killed himself. And the 58-year-old man went to thank the young widow, fell in love with her, divorced his wife of 35 years, married her, and 2 years later, to the day, he put a gun to his head and shot himself in exactly the same way. And the theory is that the heart has molecules and carries with it some of the characteristics of the heart donor. And in this case, the theory is that the characteristics of a chronic depressive went with that heart. Now, a lot of doctors will say, "No, that's not true." But I spoke to a man who had a heart transplant, and I said, "What do you think?" "Oh," he said, "absolutely." He said, he was an executive, and he said, "I've always been roughshod on people's feelings. I never cared what I said to them. I put it out, and I didn't make it easy, and if anything, I made it tough." Now, he said, coming to death's door may have a part of it, but I honestly think I received the heart of a much nicer person than I am, because I am always more considerate of what I say to the other guy. And there are 70 examples. Somebody who never had a glass of beer woke up with a craving for beer. Somebody else who hated candy had to have a bar of chocolate. And there are 70 examples. The doctors won't agree. But I thought, I didn't write about that man, but I thought, suppose a young woman prosecutor gets the heart of an actress who has died, and she does not know who. Often they don't want to know the donor, and the donors don't want to know them. And she, and the husband of the actress is on trial for her murder. And she is prosecuting the husband of the man. She had been his wife. And her heart is saying to her, "You're wrong. You're wrong. He didn't do it." And of course she doesn't know why, and the husband breaks down on the stand and he says to his lawyer, "But she reminded me of Natalie so much. She has that certain way of turning. She has that look." He said, "I became so disconcerted." So I didn't write about that case, of course, but the idea of the heart carrying knowledge and then having it turned into a case where a prosecutor is prosecuting what would have been her husband. So every little thing, you take the DNA of the case, or at least I do. I don't take the whole case, but what is the DNA of the case? I read an article about, about identical twins. That was the book Two Little Girls in Blue. And Anderson Cooper's mother is the famous Gloria Vanderbilt, the debutante of years ago. Her mother, Gloria Vanderbilt Sr., as they called her, was an identical twin. When her sister, when she was giving birth in England, Gloria Vanderbilt Sr., a young woman, collapsed in the Colony Club with agonizing abdominal pains. She went through the birth process with her sister. And I thought, there's a story in there somewhere where identical twins are kidnapped. One gets back, a three-year-old, and the other one is communicating. They are communicating. They are sure the other one is dead. And Michael Corder, my wonderful editor, said, Mary, a lot of people won't believe this is true. You've got to have a person in that book. It'll be a pediatrician who specializes in twins, so that she is saying to the FBI, watch her, she's communicating, listen to what she's saying. So that gave the validity that a non-believer might give. Not all identical twins are that close, but in many cases, one of them will get an injection and the other one will start screaming because it is so close. And years ago, a senator's twin daughter was murdered, and they still are not sure whether they were after her or her identical twin. I think it was in Illinois, and the surviving sister is married to Jay Rockefeller, the senator from West Virginia. But they never, because the dog didn't bark, they felt it was somebody who was known in the house, but they think they might have been after the wrong sister. But I thought the idea of identical twins, who are little ones, communicating, and at the Mass of the Innocent, for the child they think has been drowned, they saw a box thrown out over the ocean, and the one who's surviving tugs her mother and says, Kathy wants to come home right now. So I thought the idea of it, and that's the way you get ideas, where you get the emotional end of it in as well. Because I think you must have emotion in a book. Somebody has to be in emotional agony to solve this problem. The one I'm working on right now, 27 years later, the mother says, you're moving to New York. The sister had disappeared. She said, you know, I watch these crime programs, and they have so many other ways of finding out. See if you can talk to the detectives. See it, because he said, I know she's dead, but I would like her home. And that's the subplot of the book I'm working on now. But it's easy, you know, it's easy to find because there are so many circumstances. And the other thing is, we all have to be aware. Cell phones, the ability to track a car. In the last book, I used a global tracer, where the guy in the garage is stealing expensive cars. He puts a tracer on them and watches. And when he sees they're not being used, that the family is probably away. But we've got to be aware of all of this. Now you can get a license number, I guess, and you can trace the car. So we can't get away without being totally aware of what's available to the police.
My mother enjoys being here at this convention and seeing people who read her books, but she also hears from people. But I thought you might want to share some of the stories about some of the kids who have written to you.
Oh, I love them. I just love them. One of the first letters I got was from a 13-year-old kid, and he wrote, I have it on my desk still, when Where Are the Children came out. Dear Mrs. Clark, I have read the first half of Where Are the Children. You are a wonderful writer. Someday I hope to read the second half.
And the boring parts. The boring parts.
Oh, yes, and the 13-year-old girl wrote...
At school.
A school kid wrote, Dear Mrs. Clark, I love your books so much, I don't even mind the boring parts. They'll keep you honest. And one day I was signing out in Long Island, you know, which is local, of course, for me, and I had just finished, and I was just getting up to go, and a woman came in breathless. Oh, I'm so glad I got you. I'm so glad. I wanted to get your autograph. You're my favorite writer of junk literature. I said, oh, thank you very much. Oh, she said, you're welcome.
And the signing you did in the department store that time?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, when you start, nobody knows you. And when I started, I was signing, actually it was out in Minneapolis, and nobody knew who I was from Adam. And I sat for 2 hours, and nobody bought a book, nobody. And in fact, they got so used to seeing me, they were saying, where is the lingerie sale? And I said, oh, second floor rear. So I was directing them, and finally, I had a Coke in front of me, and finally some woman came up to me and she said, oh, can I have one of those? I said, she said, where can I get one of those? Oh, I said, right here, and I opened a book, and she said, no, I mean the Coke.
So
we all go through that kind of situation when we're starting, you know, and we value other readers so much. Because without the readers, without the librarians, without the booksellers, without the people who say, I get your book the minute it comes out, or I gave it to my mother, without you, we don't exist. So I hope that all my writer friends, I know share the sentiment, but I hope all of you know how much we appreciate you. Because it's such fun to be in this wonderful game. It's such fun, and it's torture. To sit down and start a new book is absolute torture. I remember Jean, she wrote Mary, Mary, and Please Don't Eat the Daisies. It was Jean, I forget her last name at the moment. Yeah. That's right, yes. And she said before she started, she would clean out the closets and she would read the contents of a tomato can with fascination. Anything but get up to that computer and start again. And Edna Ferber's housekeeper said, oh, I knew when Miss Edna was going to start a new book or she'd start vacuuming. So it's not as though, you know, you sit down and the thoughts just run through your head and you put them down. And Barbara Cartland, remember the romance writer, very, very popular. She was Princess Di's stepmother. But I remember when she came over and she either wore all white or all pink. And she got on one of the television programs and they said, well, you know, do you plan a book? How does it start? Oh, she said, I go in my garden. And of course, I'm always dressed. And I look at my beautiful flowers. And I don't wish to feel as though my secretary is present. But she is there behind a flower bush. I see the secretary. And she said, I think these beautiful thoughts about these beautiful people, and I say them aloud, and my secretary takes them down, and then I have a book. I thought, good, Barbara, good for you, kid.
We actually don't have that much time left. You'd like to take a few questions.
Oh, sure, I'd love to
There's
get
only
questions.
5 minutes left, I realize. Is that right? Yes, so... does anybody have a burning question? Or my mother can keep talking. Yes. Do you do an outline?
I have to know what the book is about. I mean, that's essential, of course.
Oh, I'm sorry. She asked, basically, do you have an outline? Is the question.
Or how do you get started?
What is your routine when you're starting a book?
Well, the routine, why don't I give you the last one, because this one it would be too convoluted to talk about. But Michael Corder, my wonderful editor, said, Mary, I wish you would write a book with a biblical reference in it. say, a letter from Christ to someone. And I said, Michael, are you absolutely crazy? I said, that doesn't work. It could seem irreverent or religious. It could. But I kept coming back to it because I thought, yes, indeed, Christ, we knew he was educated. He was a Jewish boy who studied in temple. And at 12, he was confounding the elders with his knowledge of the scriptures. And I kept coming back and I thought, who would he have written to? Well, Joseph of Arimathea had been a lifetime disciple, a quiet one, secret. And he was the one, and upon Sunday, in the psalm it would, said, and Joseph of Arimathea, a good and righteous man, and a disciple of Christ, had the courage to go to Pilate and ask for the body of the crucified Christ to bury in his own tomb. So I thought, yes, he might very well have written a letter to Joseph thanking him for his kindness. And now, it had been stolen from the Vatican in the year 400-something, and it has shown up, and a biblical scholar is murdered for it. And I thought, yes, I can use this within the framework, but then who is the scholar? Who would be likely to have committed the murder to steal it? Well, he has four colleagues he might have shown it to authenticate it. What else would be interesting? His wife has Alzheimer's, and she knows he has a girlfriend, which is the sad thing with Alzheimer's. You know, after years, the partner who has lost his companion, even though he takes care of her, may very well have a girlfriend. So you get all the elements together and then say, okay, where did this open? Where does this open? And I thought, I did a prologue of it being stolen from the Vatican. It opens the day of the funeral. And I started it, the father's funeral, I started it in the voice of my main character and didn't like it. I wrote 50 pages, and it was really 4 months' work. And I thought, I don't like her in the first person. She belongs in the third person. So for me, the first 50 pages are murderous. I write and I rewrite and I rewrite, and I say, no, her name isn't Jennifer. She's not a Jennifer. She's someone else. Because the people come to life. And I have to tell you a quick story, and that is, do you use people you know? Well, yes, sometimes you say, she dresses like her. You know, because the way people dress, not better or worse, but it says something. Do you wear cardigans, or are you always in a frilly blouse? You know, it says something about you. And neither good nor bad, but it's defining. And there was one character, a guy I knew, and he was very nice, but he was one of those, his father went to Harvard, of course he went to Harvard, and the Hasty Pudding Club, and you know, all that stuff. You got that every time you met him. And yet he was a nice guy. But I had a character in the book fashioned on him. And doesn't matter which book. But when I get my first copy of a book, I read it as a reader, not as the writer, saying, wait a minute, there's a better word here. And when I got to the part about him, I almost fainted. He jumped out. You couldn't miss him. I almost died. I said, how can I have come so close to the bone? How can I have been so stupid? How can I have not seen this? And a few weeks went by, and his wife phoned me. And she said, Mary, John and I have read your book. I was bleeding. I said, yes. And she said, that character... Yes. John and I know so many people just like him. Thank you. I will never come that close to the bone again. I promise you, dear God. I promise you.
I think we have to wrap up, but do you want to tell the story of when we were on the boat, what happened?
Again,
she's so honored to be here, and...
You tell that story. You tell it better than I do, but go ahead.
Okay. When we were doing the research for our book, Santa Cruz, we took a cruise together just to absorb ourselves of being on a boat and get to work on the book, and it was a great big boat, big families, you know. So we were just wandering around like lost souls the first day, and we got off an elevator, and we saw the captain standing by a staircase, so we went over and introduced ourselves and said, we're going to write a book on a cruise, and he could care less, you could tell. So All of a sudden, the elevator doors opened, and a woman saw my mother, and she came charging over, and she said, "Excuse me, but I'd love to get a picture." And my mother said, "Sure." And she started smiling, and the woman said, "Could you get out of the way, please?" She wanted a picture with the captain.